Do you remember when you first expressed an interest in music as well as percussion?
It was like super late. I actually am a late bloomer. I didn't actually start playing music or percussion until I was 18. I was in college. So that's when I first started to just mess around with other people's drums, and I realized, wow, this is something I could actually probably do if I practiced.
Yeah. Now, you're originally from India, right?
Yeah.
Now, when you were growing up, did you come from a musical family? Were any of your family members musical?
I did not per se, but one of the things that's always interesting about this question to me is I was always around tons of music, and I grew up not only in India, but like I would spend time in the Middle East, spent time growing up in like Australia, in different parts of Asia, and I just realized I was always around street music, around different genres of music, and I had internalized all that, and I hadn't even realized that, man, all these influences were already inside. And then when I started playing, all of this stuff just started coming out.
Yeah, it's more or less like one gigantic musical sandbox.
Yeah, totally. That's a good way to put it. Yeah, and you know, sometimes you don't realize your unconscious influences until later, right?
Yeah, it's like osmosis, you know.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. You know, osmosis, internal, unconscious, subconscious, I don't know.
And you know what's really nice is that when you're out there on stage expressing and playing this music, sometimes you sort of wonder, where is this coming from?
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. And when you get older and you study it, and then you can sort of put your finger on it and say, ah, that's what it is. But when you're younger and you don't quite know what the theory is, or, you know, when you don't quite know what you're doing, you just do it.
Yeah, it just all happens.
Yeah, totally. So, yeah, definitely. So, you know, I mean, and then I started studying jazz with Andrew Surreal.
One
a great jazz drummer, yeah. Are you familiar with his work?
Andrew Surreal and Bob Moses are two of my favorite drummers.
No way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love Andrew Surreal.
And as you know, that they are two of my main teachers.
Yeah. And what did you pick up from studying with them?
Oh, my God. You know, that could be a whole dissertation. But, I mean, very different things. First of all, studying with Andrew was the most pivotal experience of my life. I've gone through many other jazz drummers who shall remain nameless. and you know, they all wanted me to be like a swing drummer. They were like, no, you can't play jazz like that. It's got to be like this. And yeah. And I was just playing all these, you know, like I said, unconscious rhythms. It was all just coming out when I was auditioning for them or whatever. And they all wanted to break me, right? And Andrew was the first guy I went to. He heard me play for 2 minutes and said, cool, I hear what you have, but I hear what you don't have, and let's build on that. And nobody else had said that. Nobody else. And I was like, man, that's what I want in a teacher, somebody who can, like, understand what I already have going, not try to wipe away my entire cultural experience.
So in essence, what he's doing is just digging really deep into you and just pulling out the best of you.
At best of me, and also knowing like what I needed, meaning like how to build on what I have, and that's what any good teacher should do in anything, right?
That's
like
right.
You build on what you have. Okay, you may know A, B, C, but how about D, E, F? You know, and maybe you don't know that, but as opposed to saying, okay, forget everything you know, I'll teach you 1, 2, 3, you know, and that's what all the other teachers were doing. So it was not only what I had inside, but also building on what I could use as internal building blocks to approach other concepts through my own concept. Does that make sense?
It sure does. I have to tell you that when I went to your website and I looked at the concert you did at the Montreal International Jazz Festival, the first name that came up for me was Don Cherry for some reason.
Wait, which festival?
I think it was the Montreal Jazz Festival.
Montreal Jazz? I don't think we did that.
Oh, because I saw a video on your website where you're performing.
Oh, that's from a performance in Montreal, but it's not at the Jazz Festival. Okay,
Okay.
It's definitely Montreal, yes.
Yeah, and the first person I thought of for some reason was Don Cherry.
Absolutely.
You know, and you performed with him, didn't you?
I have not, no, but I perform with people that work close to him, like Peter Applebaum or Adam Rudolph or just different people who've been in contact with Don. But, you know, keep in mind that I was playing with Kala Purusha, and I know that was one of the questions he wanted to ask of me. Right. And he was pivotal because he was coming out of that post Don Cherry, post free jazz, you know, all of that. And he had a lot to say about the music of Don Cherry and how he internalized that into his own playing. And that was very influential for me.
What are your top five jazz recordings of all time?
One of my pivotal recordings definitely would be like when I heard John McLaughlin with that trio he had with Trila Gurtu, that was live at Albert Hall in London. That's one of them. And one of my other favorites of all time is the Dewey Redmond duo with Ed Blackwell. One else would be the Silent Way box set by Miles. And then pretty much all of the Air stuff that was Henry Threadgill's, you know, Henry Threadgill.
What an awesome band that was.
Right.
Steve McCall.
And then also pretty much, you know, and I would say anything by the, you know, being a drummer, like I always tend to gravitate towards musical drummers. Anything by Jim Black or Hamid Drake. Really, you know, I haven't yet to hear them put out a bad recording.
Jim is one of my favorite drummers as well.
And I love Hamid, and you know, I try to emulate kind of like both of them and bring my own sound to it, and because I just think what each of them does is so amazing and so musical, you know.
I like the work that Jim did with Satoko Fuji.
The quartet with Mark Dresser.
That's right.
Yeah, that's fantastic stuff.
Who are some of the important influences on your playing?
Wow, like I said, the recording with John McLaughlin was super pivotal, just listening to Trila Gurtu. And I'd never heard a drummer who would take all those influences, these so-called world music influences, put it all together with jazz and this and that. I've never heard anything like it. And, you know, it just blew my mind. So he was one of the first percussionists who actually, you know, spoke to me and said, wow, I can do this. I can actually find a way to kind of like blend my own influences with jazz or whatever. Mm-hmm. So that was pivotal. And then hearing, you know, just John Coltrane, Miles Davis, Duke Ellington, Sun Ra. And then, you know, I also grew up with a lot of rock and a lot of other music. And I used to live in England for a minute. I used to listen to a lot of like alternative rock and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So everything from like, man, you know, bands like The Cult or like, you know, whatever, just, I mean, just Led Zeppelin, you know, just bands that had a really intense groove, especially bands like Led Zeppelin, you know, had such an amazing groove thing going.
Definitely.
Yeah, I always gravitated to that. And then, of course, you know, a lot of world music, absolutely everything from Caetano Veloso to Baba Mal to, it could go on and on, you know. So many, many things. And I think I have a section under my website for influences. I don't know if you got a minute to check that out.
Yeah, it was quite extensive, actually.
Yeah, so that's like, yeah, so I could just sit there and rattle off all those names. But definitely, like, you know, anything, you know, one of the things Elvin Jones had said in an interview was, you know, as his advice, was always check out what you're not into. And, you know, when I was growing up, that always stuck with me. I was like, yeah, it's easy to be in your comfort zone, right?
I have always told people that I like to buy music that I don't like, if that makes any sense, that I'm not familiar with. Because
totally.
You mentioned the importance of a comfort zone. People get stuck in that and they miss out on so much.
Absolutely. You know? And, you know, especially, look, I mean, I don't know how many, like, trade magazines you read by drummers or bass players or whatever. But, you know, a lot of these guys, man, when they talk about their influences and stuff, it's the same regurgitative influences along so-called party lines, you know. Mm-hmm. Or rock drummers would go, oh, John Bonham, Keith Moon, or, you know,
right.
Ringo Starr, and the jazz drummers are going, Philly Joe Jones, Elvin Jones, Max Roach, Roy Haynes. And those are all fantastic people, don't get me wrong, but
Yeah. There's
so much out there. I mean, my God, Japanese percussion, Indian percussion, African percussion, Brazilian percussion, ethnic percussion from all over Africa. I mean, there's so much.
Right.
And how could you exclude all of that? You know,
yeah.
it just boggles my mind that people would not be interested in checking that out, you know?
Exactly. If there's only one person living today that you would love to perform with, who would that be?
Wow, that's living today. I would love to perform with Henry Threadgill.
Yeah, Definitely. I would agree with you. He's the only surviving member, I think, of Air.
Yeah, and also, like, I mean, yeah, and then listening back to his music, I see so much of what I do that would kind of like dovetail with his musical concept. And I know people that work in his band. I'm friends with people that play with him, and I just think, like, man, that will be so awesome, like, 'cause yeah, I think he's just such a revolutionary, and his music sounds like nothing I've ever heard anywhere, but yet it's accessible at the same time, and which is something I try to strive for in my own music.
When I looked at that video on your website, I was just struck by how that piece started and just got totally involved. It was interesting.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it
Would you
was.
have, how'd you, that, you know, how, to ask you a question in turn, how would you, let's say, because this is very interesting to me, like, and you listen to so much music.
Yeah.
When you first watched it or listened to it, how would you have categorized it? Like, where in your brain, where would it have fallen? I'm just really curious.
Well, number one, I don't categorize music. For me,
That's
it's just for
good.
me, it's just music.
Right.
So my ears are always open. There's really no categories, and it was just the feel, the vibe that I was getting from watching that, and the way it progressed, the way that there was this symbiotic interaction with the other group members,
Right.
that I found musically stimulating.
Right.
And that's.
But the reason I asked you that, because I'll include that link in my press kit, my electronic press kit, and you'll just be amused by a lot of the answers we get. People will
Oh.
write back and say, "Oh, we don't book world music," or "Oh, we don't book
Yeah.
jazz." I always wondered, did people actually watch this? Because we're all the above and none of the above, and so
I
a
think
lot of promoters and curators are just sometimes more rigid than I hope they would be.
well, you know, I think that your mind always has to become a tabula rasa when it comes to music.
I hope so, but you're in a different boat, man. But you know what I mean? Like, but you know what I'm talking about. A lot of the promoters, they're not.
Yeah, it's very tough. It's very tough. How did the Trio Tirana come about?
The trio came about in 2002, actually. It's been through a couple of reincarnations, and I first took the band to India. It was a saxophone and a stand-up bass, Peter Epstein and Danny Zanker on bass, and it was all my compositions. And we just toured, had a State Department grant to tour India, and we did a few cities, and then we started playing. And I was started identifying with my own culture again. Keep in mind, I hadn't been to India in almost 10, 12 years before that visit in 2002, and it was like an awakening for me. I was like, wow, I can find a way to put it all together. And so that was my first pass at it, but I realized, like, this isn't cutting it. I'm hearing something a little different than just sax and bass. So then I just happened to come across Jason Huang and Shahnir Blumenkrantz, who happened to play acoustic bass and the oud, and we just clicked, and that's how the band got started in 2003. And immediately, within a year of playing together, we got this amazing record deal from Clean Feed Records. And then we were off, and within a year of that release, we'd already toured and played in like six international countries. So, for our short lifespan, we've actually traveled quite extensively and done, two recordings and, that kind of thing.
What does Tirana mean?
Tirana is a word from North Indian classical music, which actually means a composition or a musical piece made up on the spot using mnemonic devices. As you know, in Indian music, they use vocal syllables, right?
Right.
Sort of analogous to do re mi or whatever. So tarana is actually a very specific thing in Indian classical music, where in that segment, the tabla player or whatever will just, or the percussionist or the melody player will just start reciting syllables based on some, loose concept, and they will just improvise off of that rhythm. And I thought, man, that's kind of cool. So I can take that and apply it to jazz, where in jazz, you're improvising most of the time anyway, but what if we improvise off of specific rhythmic concepts in addition to improvising off of standard melodies? So that's sort of like, and I wanted to include that concept in addition to written music.
How long did it take to record Mirren, which is your latest release, right?
It took a whole year, yeah. It's been a work in progress for a long time. I mean, we've been going back and forth first. It ended up being a studio recording, which took like almost half a year to put together, and then we decided to scrap that. And now what you hear is 85% live and 15% studio. So, and then we weren't happy with it, and the band kept growing. So we just decided to record our last U.S. tour in March 2006, and then we reworked that. So all in all, it almost took like, yeah, 8 9 months to a year to put together.
Were there any challenges along the way when you were recording the
Yeah,
album?
well, the biggest challenge was the band quit on me.
That's a challenge.
Yeah, I'm like, oops, we gotta start again. So Jason and Shiner, they had divergent interests and their own bands were getting busier. So they left, and in the meantime, we'd started the record. I'm like, okay, this sucks. So then I have to put together a new band, and of course, you can't just take a new band in the studio cold. So that's what I meant when I said a year. So all of that processing time, rehearsal, breaking in the band, and then playing to the vibe of those specific members, putting all that together, then we sort of got into the studio. So yeah, it was quite a process.
Did the internet play a role in this at all?
How do you mean that?
In terms of, for example, you might record something and then send it off to one of the musicians in the band to embellish or whatever, and then send it back, that
I
sort
mean,
of
the
thing.
band is such an integrated, organic concept. It was really like, coming up with the parts together. But the internet did play a part in finding substitutes. Like I would go into people's MySpaces or what have you, and then say, oh, this person lives in New York, and they play the violin or the viola, and they'd be great for my band if Sam isn't available or whatever. And so it played a part in that sense, but not necessarily in the formation of the music.
Okay. Does it take you a long time to compose a piece of music?
Yes and no. I mean, again, like I said, some of these ideas have been gestating in my head since I was a kid, right? All these travels, all these experiences, all these rhythms that blended together, all these fractured melodies that could be Middle Eastern or Indian or Japanese or reggae, rock, whatever. Just all of it is just kind of sitting there, and I just pull pieces out. So sometimes it just comes out within hours. Sometimes I'll be reworking a composition or rearranging a piece for years. So, like some of the music on Miren has been around since my first CD, but we did not record it, but we just rearranged and I rewrote it. And some of the pieces I just wrote sort of like just for the recording, so it's a mix.
What do you like most about composing?
The main reason I wanted to even be a leader was because I wanted to have my own concept. And for me, composition is extremely special because I wasn't hearing anything like what I wanted to do in any other people's music. So for me, composition is like the biggest release as to like, this is my band, this is my sound, I'm writing for my musicians, and I have total control over that process. And to the extent that I am providing the thematic material, and that's really why I started, even being a band leader.
So when it comes to composing, who are some of your influences?
Again, some of the people you mentioned, like Henry Threadgill, Don Cherry, the Art Ensemble of Chicago, just listening to like just so many different things, like bits of like rock music, bits of new music, been sort of also influenced by like Ligeti or Berio or like Penderecki. I just hear some of these things on our second track, Fiza, that's sort of like inspired by this like Penderecki-esque beginning, and then it goes into this Middle Eastern groove from that. So, just so many different things. And I want to get more into harmony and more into more long form composition. And that's one of my goals and my challenges.
Do you ever have a chance to teach or mentor other musicians?
All the time. I mean, not necessarily mentor peers per se, but like I teach a lot actually. And when we're not touring, that's my main bread and butter. Like what I do is I work for a teaching artist organization that sends artists who are like professional, like myself, into schools, public schools, and we're teaching like literally second grade through eighth grade, depending on the level. And we go in, we talk to them. Right now, I'm actually teaching a jazz history course and a percussion course to like sixth graders in like underserved inner city communities.
Are you largely a self-taught musician, or do you have any formal training?
Largely self-taught, but like I said, studying with Andrew Surreal was formative, absolutely. And then when you mentioned Bob Moses, I used to go up to NEC, New England Conservatory, when he was there, or I think he's still there, I believe. And that's when I got all the so-called theory down about writing notation and being able to transcribe and transpose parts and put all that together. But I would say indeed, like that's like, you know, maybe 30, 35%, but most of it is just, you know, shedding and practicing and getting my own act together.
So you do find time to practice?
Oh yeah, I mean, when I was coming up, in college, you know, even though I was studying engineering, I used to practice, you know, sometimes 4 to 6 hours a day. Sure.
So how do you practice?
you mean now or just in general?
In general.
In general, well, you know, obviously practicing is such a methodical thing. In the beginning, it will be very specific, just going through rhythms or just trying to read pieces of written music or trying to work on temp timing. But now, for me, it's more relaxed. It's like, you know, for me, one of the main things is look approaching the drum set as one instrument as opposed to thinking of it as a hi-hat, a bass drum, whatever. So I try to, you know, think of it as one sound and try to think of how I can develop each component to be as strong as the other. So sometimes I might focus on one element alone, but primarily I work on just, you know, so many different things within a couple of hours, like, you know, tempo, trying to play different time signatures, trying to work on basic grooves, trying to improvise on basic themes, trying to develop technical ability. So there's so much, you know.
Do you have a specific drum kit, or you have a varied amount of percussion?
I have lots of percussion. I have like over 60, 60 percussion instruments from all over the world, but I have a basic 5-piece drum set that I work with and that I usually practice on. That's set up in my studio in my apartment, and I sort of work with that alone.
Regarding your drum kit, what brand is it?
It's actually an amazing brand right out of New York City called Modern Drum Shop. And it's sort of like a custom-made drum set. And this guy, Joe Casadas, he's been doing this and for quite a while. And he custom makes drum sets and he ships them all over the world. And it was just amazing for me to get like a really high-quality drum set like Gretsch or Sonar for about half the price. And they sound, you know, just as good.
And the sticks that you use, are they Vic Firth?
The sticks, yeah, I use like really tiny, you know, the sticks I use are sometimes I use Vic Firth 7As, or I might use chopsticks, or I might use Japanese taiko sticks, or you know, whatever. I mean, like, yeah, it's really open.
Interesting, very interesting. What projects do you have on the go for the rest of 2007 going into 2008?
Right now, my main touring project is Tirana. You know, as you know, like, God, it's such a rat race out there, just trying to stay alive and, you know, be musically valid and competitive. I do have help booking by a few key people in some countries, but I do a lot of the booking on my own. So, you know, when I'm not practicing or teaching, that takes up an inordinate amount of time, as you can imagine.
Yeah,
So
definitely.
I actually cut back and scaled back from some of the other projects, like, you know, you mentioned Kala Purusha, and so I kind of took a step back from that, took a step back from working with Sabir Mateen, and I was working with this German pianist, Ursel Schlicht, and her world music project. So right now, I'm down to like maybe two or three projects. I'm actually working with a rock band that's actually been recording and getting a new album ready called Fulton Lights, and that hopefully will take off in the next year. And then this jazz singer, Ellen Christie, are you familiar with her work?
Yes, I am. She's
Yeah.
been around for a while.
She has been around for a while. So I've been working with her in another context. So, you know, a few things. But really, you know, my goal is really to like, I mean, yeah, as much as it sounds like the wrong thing to do is put all my eggs in this basket called Turiya Tamana and just, you know, see how far I can go.
So with all these things going on in your life, do you ever find time to listen to music at all? Like, what are you listening to these days?
I listen to a lot. In fact, on my website, one of the things I get a kick out of is I have this thing called What's in My iPod, and I do actually update that fairly frequently. And right, and like I was saying earlier, to bring our conversation back full circle, listen to a lot of stuff that I'm not necessarily familiar with, and I'll just go to like the Lincoln Center Library or the Library of Congress. They have branches all over New York. I mean, I'm sorry, the New York Public Library. And I just pick out stuff like traditional music from Madagascar. Right now, I'm listening to music from Madagascar, like pygmy music, taiko ensembles from Japan, traditional Persian classical music featuring mei, which is Irani flute and percussion. And then, and one of my favorite rock bands right now is Deer Hoof. And I'm listening to Arcade Fire. And then I'll just jump right from that and go into like classic jazz and go into like, Billie Holiday. And I just was pulling out some, Lester Young the other day. So it's very wide, And right now, one of my main kicks is, call it having a sweet spot, but actually I'm on this like kick listening to the Bad Plus.
Yeah,
So I
they're an
think David
interesting
King is an
band.
amazing drummer, and so, just all this stuff, and also Jim Black's project called Tift. Do you know this band?
No, I don't.
Yeah, it features people I'm sure you're familiar with, Andrew D'Angelo, who plays with like Tim Burton and worked with Matt Wilson, and then Skúli Sverrisson, and no, I'm sorry, Hilmar Jensen, Icelandic pianist, guitarist. And so it's his band, and so they're pretty amazing. So listen to that. And one of my favorite drummers, also, I forgot to mention, is Jeff Kane Watts. So
Nice.
I listen to a lot of stuff that he's done right now. So yeah, all of this stuff. And yeah, one of the amazing things about having an iPod or an MP3 device is, I think that's really changed the way, maybe you can also agree with this, is how people listen to music, right? And
It's funny you say that. I was just talking to my wife the other day about that, about how years ago we had to put a record on and flip it. And I mean, if you're old
Yeah.
enough to remember that.
Right.
And
Of course I do. I have tons of records. Yeah.
yeah, I mean, records are still valid in my world, but the iPod has just changed everything. You can put
Right.
whatever you want on there, create whatever you want. It's just mind-blowing.
Yeah, you can listen to like 60 albums and just shuffle them on a weekly basis, or 100 albums or 200, whatever. And
Exactly.
for me, it's just, instead of just putting one CD in my CD Walkman and taking it out into New York, I can listen to like, 15 or 20 songs from 15, 20 different albums instead. And that's huge. So definitely, I listen to a lot more music than I used to in the past.
So, aside from playing percussion, do you play any other instrument?
I do not actually, but I would love to learn to play the piano so I can compose better. And I would, given a whole lifetime to do this. But right now, I really want to focus on just mastering my instruments. So there's such a world of knowledge just in playing, just percussion and trying to master and integrate different styles into my own sound. And that's just my biggest challenge right now. So I feel like, while I would love to do these other instruments, I've got my hands full because I play cajon and dumbek and different hand percussion and drum sets and so a lot of different variety of percussion instruments within that world.
So, as a percussionist, do you remember your first performance?
I do. It was actually protesting the first U.S. involvement in the Gulf War, and it was
Interesting.
just like a random thing, and I just started playing a drum beat and got involved with other percussionists. But I remember that very clearly. That was in 1991.
Wow. You mentioned earlier about Maurice McIntyre.
Yeah.
I've always loved his music. What was it like performing with him, and what influence did he have on you?
Amazing. That's an amazing question. One of the first and most amazing things about those guys who are coming out of the AACM is they're very different from the other free jazz guys or women. They have a very specific approach to incorporating everything, like new Western classical music, Indian classical music, African music, whatever. And those guys were so open because to me, for them, all music was valid and useful as thematic material. And Kalle Pusha himself and his music, first of all, he was using me, I mean, I'm not exactly like your typical jazz drummer or even your typical free jazz drummer. And he just let me kind of do what I wanted to do. And his own compositions would involve so many different worlds and blended all through his world of blues. And, you know, he grew up very heavily playing the blues and all of that. So, you know, it really reinforced in me the idea that you can kind of like be rooted in something like blues, for instance, or swing. And then, but you can draw on so many different things, and music is so open, and that's one of the biggest things I learned. And that the guy's 70 years old now, but like he's still open to playing with anything, you know. And like all those guys, like George Russell, I mean George Russell, George Lewis, right? Anthony
Right.
Braxton, Muhal Abrams, to me, Rascal Mitchell, they're
That's
still
cool.
doing it, you know. They're
Yeah.
still creating, and they're working with laptops and electronic musicians and Chinese pipas, and nobody else really in jazz is doing it, really, in my honest opinion.
Yeah. How would you define jazz?
Wow, that's such an open question. To me, jazz is really like, first of all, you know, it's undeniable that it's coming from the blues tradition, absolutely, because I do, you know, I'm aware of where it's coming from. But beyond that, to me, it's one of the most open musics. And to me, jazz is freedom, is improvisation, is the chance to express your own personality. And that's all I would say. I mean, to me, I would not say anything more about harmony or melody or certain rhythmic things. Because, you know, look, it's always been open to people started bringing in European music. Then we had European influenced jazz in the 1920s, 30s. And then we got Latin jazz coming into the 40s. And then, you know, to me, when I'm bringing in Asian traditions or music into it, to me, it's just as valid as what Dizzy Gillespie and Chano Buzo and, you know, all those guys were doing. And I don't think that what I'm doing is any different or what anybody else after me comes in and brings into it. So to me, it's all jazz. I don't call it world jazz. I don't call it experimental, or to me, it's just jazz, you know. But of course, as you know, when you say jazz, people have a very specific concept in mind, usually.
Yeah, they sure do. One of my favorite musicians of all time, in fact, I named my radio show after one of his albums, is Cecil Taylor.
Oh, yeah.
Do you listen to his music at all?
I do, yeah. One of my favorite recordings is Indent, one of his solo recordings. And of course, I love Unit Structures, Andrew Surreal and Jimmy Lyons. And I actually got to work with Rafay Malik, this amazing trumpet player who
Nice.
worked on and off with Cecil for like 10, 15 years. So I actually got to be quite intimate with Cecil's biography from the inside. It was like a privilege, and just knowing how he approaches music and his concept of improvisation. And, you know, Cecil's a very smart guy, and it is inspiring because, you know, you may not necessarily think his musical influences are as diverse just listening to his music, but he's very studied, he's very thorough, and he absolutely knows what he's doing. And it was very inspiring to me, absolutely.
He's still out there performing.
Absolutely, yeah, it's amazing.
You know, you look at Sam Rivers, the same thing. He's out there and
Cecil, Farrah
Yusef Lateef.
Sanders, Ornette Coleman, those guys are still doing it.
Well, you know, it's funny because a while back I happened to catch Yusef Lateef in concert,
Oh, man.
and it was just a mind-blowing show. I mean, he's well into
Word.
his 80s now.
Right. Where did you see him play?
He was here at the Ottawa Jazz Festival. And it was just incredible.
I see.
I mean, the intensity they brought out of his band was awesome.
Yeah, they're, you know, I hate to say it, but they're last of a dying breed, and you know, it's like they're the real deal, and as far as I'm concerned, you know, like yeah, nowadays this, you know, that's a whole nother conversation we can have about the education industry in music, you know, but we'll leave that for another time. But
Well, you know,
yeah, to me, Yusuf and those guys are just the real deal, and you know, it's just inspiring that they're still around.
actually, I was talking to Mark Egan recently, and I mentioned that about how in the past you had these bands that were schools in and of themselves, and you don't really have that these days. For example, Miles Davis's bands along the way, and even Art Blakey was a
All those
great
guys.
place for musicians, and now it's so institutionalized
Completely.
that the music is altered, I think.
Absolutely, man, you're totally 1,000% right. And you know, we talk about this all the time, and it's a matter of fact, the saddest thing, because look, if you were an institution that made billions of dollars, why would you want to ruin a good thing? And I think, you know, they just found out, because look, now there's more people playing this music than there's actual listening audience.
That's right.
And it's just like the New School, Berklee, New England Conservatory, and all the other so-called conservatories and schools of jazz all across Canada and the US. And it's just mind-boggling. Like, they're spitting out all these kids, but where are they going to play? What are they actually going to do? Who are they going to play for?
Yeah. The best, well, maybe I think I found the answer.
Yeah, what
Start
is
a
it?
reality show.
Yeah, or just have your MySpace up. My God,
That's
it's like,
right.
yeah, it's crazy.
Ravish, what was the most memorable concert that you ever attended?
One of my most memorable concerts was actually fairly recently, as this band Deerhoof, actually,
I'm
they're
not
from San
familiar with
Francisco,
them.
and I thought they were very amazing. I'd never seen a live rock band that has so much improvisation, and yet was able to hold such a tight concept and a very unique idea of improv and elements of abstract free jazz and still having like, rock melodies all blended together. And what a show. And I always, that's always been one of my dreams is to have like a jazz band with that kind of rock intensity, not necessarily playing rock music, right? But having that kind of intensity. So that's been one of my most inspiring things. And second, I would say, even though you didn't really ask me second, just anything, seeing Jim Black live. And
Right.
I've been following his career since literally 94, 95, when he was just a young lad coming into New York and playing with Tim Burton and whatnot. And every time I see him play, it's just like watching art. I mean, there's no bad gigs watching him play. So I would say that really has been, those are some of my favorite concerts of all time.
That rock band that you just mentioned, where are they from?
They're from San Francisco.
And what are they called again?
Deerhoof, Deerhoof. They're pretty huge right now. They just got, yeah, if you Google them or look them up now, they're pretty, they've been around for like 10, 15 years, I believe. And now, David Byrne had something to do with, and I'm sorry, David Bowie had something to do with it, and he put them on the map in some way, putting them on a touring circuit or this or that. So now they're just blowing up.
I'm really gonna have to check them out.
I think you'd dig them, like, yeah, I think they use horn sections and they use really crazy rhythms. I mean, like, it's not your typical rock band. And live, they really go nuts. Like, they improvise a lot. And, it's a Japanese singer, a bass player, and a drummer. That's it.
Wow. Ravish, it's been a real pleasure having you on the show today.
Thank you. Thank you, Randy. Really appreciate your time. I'm glad we were able to make this happen.